This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Oh, February 18th is the day. The Israeli regime is supposed to leave South Lebanon. Defying the ceasefire agreement, Tel Aviv insists that it will keep its military in five strategic locations inside of Lebanon. Today, saw Israeli occupation forces withdraw from several southern Lebanese towns. And afterwards, Lebanese troops were deployed to towns close to the border. Now, the Israeli regime has violated the ceasefire agreement many times since it came into effect. The question now is, what is next? Will the ceasefire hold? And what are the possibilities that the conflict could restart? Let's first take a look at the following report.
Israeli occupation forces continue to violate the agreement reached with Lebanon, even after the deadline has lapsed.
The IDF will complete the withdrawal from Lebanon today. We are temporarily remaining in five strategic high points necessary for our security.
The incomplete withdrawal of Israeli occupation forces coincided with the demolition of neighborhoods in some areas, as well as attacks on residents returning to their leveled houses. Lebanese soldiers have been deployed to the villages from which Israeli troops have withdrawn, as stipulated in the agreement. They are engaged in clearing blocked roads and searching for unexploded ordnance prior to permitting the residents to return. On the political front, the Lebanese presidency has condemned the ongoing presence of Israeli troops, labeling it an occupation and a violation of the deal. The Lebanese presidency prioritized its coming steps as follows.
Firstly, to turn to the UN Security Council, which approved Resolution 1701, to demand that it takes the necessary measures to address Israeli violations and oblige Israel to immediately withdraw to the international borders. Secondly, to consider the continued Israeli presence in any inch of Lebanese territory as an occupation with all the legal consequences that result from that in accordance with international legitimacy.
It went many steps forward in asserting Lebanon's right to resistance against any occupier.
In conclusion, the attendees affirmed the Lebanese state's adherence to its full national rights and sovereignty over its entire territory, and also affirmed Lebanon's right to use any means to ensure the withdrawal of the Israeli enemy.
The ongoing Israeli violations of the ceasefire and the occupation of the five critical areas remain a contentious issue for Hezbollah, which has called for action from both the international community and Lebanese authorities.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Zakir Ahmed-Mayed, attorney, political activist, and political analyst out of Johannesburg. Fatou Sabati, activist and political analyst out of London. Well, thank you both for being with me. Let me start this off in Johannesburg. Zakir, how big of a defeat is it that the regime has not been able to totally remain in Lebanon as was its original goal?
The Israeli regime had certain goals going into the military operations against Hezbollah, and particularly the Lebanese people. It was payback for the defeat in 2006. If you look at the military information that was coming out, the military analysis, this was what they wanted to do. They wanted to reestablish their presence within Lebanese territory. They wanted to reoccupy that which they had faced defeats on in terms of the liberation of the south of Lebanon, and this was the game plan. The fact that Israel had to withdraw is a defeat within the public eye of the Israeli public. However, what is more important on the defeat aspect is whether or not Israel will be able to restore its citizens to the north. Although they have made these large-scale promises that they would repatriate their citizens back to the north, very few believe that they are safe in the north. The occupation continues, and the fact that Israel is not willing to fully withdraw creates a situation where the resistance as well as the Lebanese state are fully within their rights to exercise military force in defense of their land. So this creates a situation where Israel has put itself into a corner by not being able to achieve any of its objectives in that sense.
Well, Batu, why is it that the Zionist regime has continued to violate its ceasefire agreements and even kill more people? I mean, is it that the regime just doesn't want the ceasefire to hold, or is the problem something else? Your assessment of what's going on?
Yes, the entity has no choice regarding the ceasefire. Israel wants the complete free hand to essentially prevent the maintenance and the recuperation of the resistance so that the resistance is unable to rebuild itself. But Israel ultimately knows that the war will not return because the final decision is not in its hands. You know, we saw how Trump came and he said, you know, the ceasefire is going to be imposed, whether you like it or not, Netanyahu. So ultimately, it's in America's hands. America is the real guarantor over here. And so for this reason, you know, Israel is carrying out these violations because they want to keep the resistance distracted, but also they want to demoralize the Lebanese population, which has proven to be in and of itself the resistance. I mean, they have liberated the southern Lebanese villages with their own flesh. And had they not come to the borders and directly confronted the Israeli tanks at zero distance, it would probably be unlikely that Trump would have put and kind of finalized that deadline for February the 18th when Israel asked for an extension regarding its presence in the remaining areas. So ultimately, the war has taken its due course. So it's unlikely that an open-ended war will come back like it was before. And that's because Israel in these 15 months has exhausted all of its military goals that it had in the first place and was effectively unable to achieve them. So it's unlikely that the continuation, if it was likely that the continuation of war would bring results, America here would continue to give it the free hand. But that has not been proven to be the case within 15 months. So the violation of the ceasefire, it's likely to continue because this is the very nature of the Israeli occupation entity. But I don't think it would lead to a large open-ended war again because the goals and objectives of the war have ultimately been exhausted.
Okay. Well, Zaka, Israeli Armed Forces, IOF, is still deployed at 5 border posts now in southern Lebanon. Let's talk about what that means. First of all, it is a violation of the agreement, but what does it mean for Lebanon? What does it mean for the Americans and the Israelis, in your perspective?
The speech of the new president, Mr. Joseph Aoun, is very instructive in this regard. He says specifically that part of the goals of his presidency would be to expel Israel. And Israel has attempted to circumvent Hezbollah and trying to remove the resistance faction from negotiations and trying to isolate them. By continuing with their presence in Lebanon in these 5 spots, what they do is that they place the Lebanese military in direct conflict with themselves. This is indeed an occupation. There's no way of looking beyond this. And this has already been condemned. In terms of Israel's rationale for keeping these 5 positions in their control, the version that has been put to the media is that they would like to secure their citizens. Although it is a military plan, it's a military picture to create a buffer zone within Lebanese territory so as to protect itself, this is nothing but an explanation for occupation. So where we sit right now is the legitimization of the resistance that they have an obligation to resist. It places the equation as one that the Lebanese military has to remove Israel from those positions. And if they fail to do so, there's no option but for Hezbollah to continue with its armed resistance and take up arms against Israel. I concur with my fellow panelists that I don't believe it will lead to an open-ended war unless Israel develops some appetite for adventurism and does a ridiculous thing, such as bombing any targets within the funeral of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Hashim Saifuddin. That would give justification to begin a new war. However, the constraint is indeed correct. It is Donald Trump, which wants to stabilize the area, focus on larger military projects, and there is a possibility of this military project being directed towards the Islamic Republic of Iran. So, yes, Israel is constrained. They are playing these games to garner public support. However, inadvertently, they are legitimizing the resistance and placing Hezbollah as the only defender of the Lebanese people, which necessitates armed action by Hezbollah, which they are trying to avoid and trying to isolate Hezbollah, and they are failing to do so in every domain.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Too, the regime says that the U.S. gave it permission to remain at checkpoints in southern Lebanon. So on the one hand, the U.S. is one of the guarantors of the ceasefire agreement, which requires the Israeli regime to totally leave Lebanon. But on the other side, Washington is allowing IOF to remain at border checkpoints in Lebanon. I mean, your thoughts on this. What does it mean?
Yeah, so this ultimately means that America, as expected, is unreliable, and the Israeli occupation entity is unreliable. And they've always been like this. There is no agreement that they have agreed on except that it has been imposed on them. So even America wouldn't per se have pressured Israel to withdraw if there was no resistance by the people. So it is expected that these violations would continue. And in times of peace, the situation is unlikely to take that forceful military action. But ultimately, as long as the resistance is present and the people are with it, this is the most important thing. We saw in Lebanon, they destroyed everything in the southern villages that they were in, and they withdrew from it, and they remained in those five locations that you're mentioning. But this them remaining is just them floundering. They were unable to, as the honorable guest said, form a buffer zone in the south. That was ultimately one of their key objectives. They were unable to cause the resistance to withdraw from behind the Lifani, and they were unable to decisively hit the underground structure of the resistance in Lebanon. And without the resistance, even today, firing missiles, the people of the south, the rightful owners of the land, are coming back to reclaim their land despite the cost of their life. And we see that for this reason, they will also be unable to achieve what they haven't achieved through war. They will be unable to achieve through the political project in Lebanon, through hopes that the new government in Lebanon will facilitate the disarmament of the resistance. This won't happen because the people are steadfast in supporting the resistance. So ultimately, what we're seeing right now, and the focus is on the exaggeration in the political proposals that are being put forward, you know, whether from America or Israel, we see that they're proposing the worst case scenarios as plans. You know, this example of depopulation of Gaza. So negotiations are on the basis of the worst case. And meanwhile, you know, they're bringing the regional countries, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, that are involved in the negotiations along with America. So from now, the Western program is for them to place their fingers on the civilian and the internal administration within Gaza, whilst allowing for a state of relative calm that is now being overlooked by the Arab states, in addition to Europe and America. So now they're focusing, now Trump's focus is on the second phase. You know, we need to release the remaining hostages, stabilize the ceasefire, and ultimately it's almost like Trump himself is selling dreams to Netanyahu to buy this reality of a ceasefire. Otherwise, what would convince someone like Netanyahu to go forward with the ceasefire? But ultimately, there's no workable action plan even surrounding these exaggerated proposals that America and Israel has been putting forward, like the depopulation plan. But ultimately, there's no point returning to a full war because it won't lead to any results. We know, especially someone like Trump, he's very results driven. You know, the solution at hand or the strategy at hand has to bring something tangible for him to go along with it. And nor will Israel reach the places that they were unable to reach during those 15 months.
All right. Well, Zakia, I mean, how important are the actions of the new Lebanese government at this point in setting the standard for the direction that it's going to go, how it will deal with various governments and various entities? I mean, your assessment of that.
The external assessment of President Joseph Aoun has been that he would not confront Hezbollah. He would not push for the disarmament of Hezbollah. He's not in a position to do so. The recent images that have come out indicate that there is a line of communication that exists between Hezbollah and the Amal movement and President Aoun, an image depicting the Hezbollah MP, Mr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, extending a personal invitation to attend Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's funeral procession that was distributed on social media. So, yes, there is communication between Hezbollah, and I believe that they will continue to remain intact under the presidency of Mr. Aoun. However, what is of concern is the policy to isolate other partners of Lebanon. For example, there has been reports that direct flights from the Islamic Republic to Lebanon have been halted and the ban continues despite this very important event taking place on the 24th. These are methods that the Israelis and the Americans have put into place to try and isolate Lebanon from the resistance axis, which I believe will fail. These forces that have been put into place during this interim period will collapse, and it will remain a point that Hezbollah is the people. You cannot remove the heart of Hezbollah from the people. And this is exactly the lesson that came out of Gaza. They believed that they could bomb the Palestinians into submission, that they would turn against Hezbollah, the simple Dahiya principle or Dahiya plan that was put into place by Ghadi Eisenkot and Giora Island in 2006. And this failed in Lebanon. It failed in Gaza more recently, and it will fail again for a second time in Lebanon as they try and isolate Hezbollah from the people. Now, the Lebanese military, at the end of the day, has to answer to the people. And the people remain firmly in the corner of Hezbollah as the defenders of Lebanon against Israel. And the fact that they continue to hold these five positions justifies, as I said earlier, the position taken by Hezbollah that they have to resist by armed means, therefore solidifying Hezbollah's position within the mind of the public and internationally as well. And I don't believe the government will move against Hezbollah in any manner or form, except on a superficial level.
All right. Well, back to your thoughts. I mean, today we saw more, Zaki was talking about the Lebanese people. We saw more Southerners going back into their towns. As we had after the 60-day, the original 60-day ceasefire, we saw many of them going back to their towns. As opposed to the other side of the border, Zaki had mentioned earlier about the northern occupied territories. Tell me the difference, because we haven't seen a lot of movements from the Zionists and returning to that area, as that was also one of the goals for them to return immediately. I mean, your thoughts on the difference.
Yes, ultimately, this reflects the promise also that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah made, and that is that the settlers will not return back to the north, which was one of the key goals and objectives behind entering into that open confrontation with Lebanon. The reason that the Israeli occupation entity is continuing to keep those five border posts inside of Lebanon and to keep themselves stationed there is because ultimately they want their settlers to return back. They want to return back to a status quo, business as usual, and they want to give them a false feeling of safety. Until now, as you've mentioned, they've not gone back. And the people of the resistance have returned back, despite returning back to their damaged and destroyed homes. So ultimately, Israel here wants to create a false facade sense of confidence. We also mentioned how Israel's ultimate goal was to create a buffer zone. This was something that they were unable to do. They wanted to get the resistance back behind the Litani. All of this shows their level of failure. Right now, we see them withdrawing except from those five specific points. It is enough for the resistance to still be present on the ground for us to call this a victory. It is enough that we're seeing the people of Lebanon congregate around the resistance despite the death and the destruction everywhere to call this a victory. The victory, the very victory, is the steadfastness on the principles. The very victory is the willingness to sacrifice. At the end, all of the solutions that America and the West want to put forward, as long as there is a resistant nation that is not moving with a directed compass, it means that all of the efforts that they may place, even all of the agreements that might come out of their efforts or their frameworks, at the end, when the people have a direction, when they have a mission, when they have their principles, this direction is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. We've seen this with the steadfastness of Gaza, and we've seen this with the steadfastness in Lebanon today. So ultimately, all of the victories that we're seeing rests on the conviction of the people on these principles and their willingness to sacrifice despite the material discomfort.
Right. Well, Zaki, there is some criticism inside of the Israeli regime that actually nothing has been learned from history, that the last time that this happened, the Israeli regime was stuck in Lebanon for 18 years. A writer, Avi Ashkenazi, says the so-called security zones during that time turned into trap for soldiers, and the same thing would happen this time around. Your thoughts about that?
That criticism is not isolated. I've seen a report from Ghadi Eisenkot saying very similarly that this will be a trap. They were not able to build a buffer zone within the north. And the fundamental objective, if we look at the military plans of both Israel, the United States, and NATO, this was a NATO war as well, their aim was to break the resistance, to break the people. And as the respected guest says as well, is that as long as the people remain intact and supportive of the resistance. There will be organic growth. We've seen it in Gaza. The figures are, again, 25,000 new recruits that have come into the ranks of Qassam. So the same thing is going to happen with Hezbollah. It's not going to stop. So regardless of the technical edge that Israel may have in terms of weapon systems and munitions, this will not win a war. They cannot eradicate the resistance. So when you have criticisms such as that you have mentioned, it comes out of the fact that you cannot defeat your enemy. They have a depth of spirituality. They have a resilience and steadfastness that the Israeli population does not have. It's exactly why they are not returning to the north. They are fearful of the north, whereas the people of the resistance embrace the difficulty and believe that after difficulty comes ease. So this is exactly the difference, and there will always be criticism of Israel's policies because Israel remains an apartheid state. That is why there was always criticism in South Africa during the apartheid regime's reign that the policies are not sustainable. Israel is the same, and it comes as no surprise that there are critics from within, even within the military establishment that structured this genocide, stating that what we are doing right now in Lebanon is a path to failure because they recognize the resilience of the people and they recognize that this is the strength of the resistance.
Well, back to really quick, 1 minute. I mean, speaking about the resilience of the people, do you still think that the Israeli regime and their supporters, the Americans and others, that they still do not understand when we look at, for example, the resistance and especially Hezbollah? Again, they thought that killing leaders in the movement or killing or wounding many Hezbollah members would actually deter the people, would turn them away from the resistance. But I want to talk about that strength of Hezbollah and a very, very different perspective that basically they will give it all, but never to allow themselves to be humiliated.
Absolutely, Marzia. I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head when you say that Israel and America have never learned anything from history. The trajectory of Israel is only going down, and the trajectory of the resistance is only going up. Despite the fact that it may have been inflicted with some material blows, we see that actually the spirit of sacrifice and steadfastness has only increased war after war. And we see that Israel has only gotten weaker and weaker throughout the wars as well. Again, Israel having to fight on seven fronts, you know, for 15 months. We've reached this point where there's ultimately no going back. We see that Israel 1982 reached the heart of Beirut, took all of Gaza, you know, at one point, but it was forced to unilaterally withdraw in 2000 and 2005, not realizing that further occupying does not bring any stability. You know, we mentioned that they went into Lebanon, they went into Beirut, and at that time, the resistance was very small in number of capabilities and capacities, and they thought that by assassinating the Secretary General of the resistance back then, okay, that that would weaken it. But ultimately, Israel's presence is built on aggression, and so all of its ways are thinking are therefore wrong. It thinks, okay, that by killing a leader, it will weaken it, but we've seen that it's only gotten weaker and weaker throughout.
All right, and on that note, so sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. Appreciate both of you being with me. Zakir Ahmed Mahi, attorney, activist, and political analyst out of Johannesburg. Batu Sabeti, activist and political analyst out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. Goodbye for now. See you next time.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible?
از راه قرآن. by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala Ahli Baytihi at-Tayyibin at-Tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of remembrance of God based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 222nd sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains the states of those who remember God, those who are immersed in His remembrance. And we reach this phrase where he says, فَلَوْ مَثَّلْتَهُمْ لِعَقْلِكَ فِي مَقَاوِمِهِمُ الْمَحْمُودَةِ وَمَجَالِسِهِمُ الْمَشْهُودَةِ. And so on and so forth. It's a very long statement, and we'll step by step break down what Imam Ali alayhi salam is telling us about the wonderful positions of these individuals.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Nahjul Balagha, also known as the Peak of Eloquence, is a compilation of sermons, letters, and sayings attributed to Imam Ali, peace be upon him, the cousin and son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and greetings be upon him and his pure household. Regarded as one of the most authoritative sources of Islamic wisdom and knowledge, this book reflects the profound insight and spiritual teachings of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on various matters, including ethics, morality, governance, and spirituality. The eloquence and wisdom exhibited in this speech and teachings within Nahjul Balagha have made it a timeless masterpiece that continues to inspire and guide Muslims and non-Muslims alike in their pursuit of truth and enlightenment. All of this is presented to you in the program Gate of Knowledge on Iran Radio.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam is telling us here to do something very seriously. He says, فَلَوْ مَثَّلْتَهُمْ لِعَقْلِكَ, that I wish you did such a thing. What thing? You imagined their state in your mind. Whose state? The state of these people who remember God. Imagine it nicely in your mind. Picture it and think about these individuals. فِي مَقَاوِمِهُمُ الْمَحْمُودَ, in those very, you can say, wonderful states, the praiseworthy positions that they have. وَمَجَالِسِهِمُ الْمَشْهُودَ, those the times when they sit and they use their time to remember God, those witnessed positions whereby the angels witness them, Allah witnesses them in that situation. وَقَدْ نَشَرُوا دَوَاوِينَ أَعْمَالِهِمْ, in what state? Here, Imam Ali alayhi salam is giving the peak of the manifestation of remembrance of these people, how they remember God. وَقَدْ نَشَرُوا دَوَاوِينَ أَعْمَالِهِمْ, in a state whereby they have opened their books of account. دَوَامِينَ أَعْمَالِهِمْ, how they open their books whereby they are looking at their actions. So he has likened the people and their actions, these people and their actions, as a book. So it's as if that person, when he contemplates on his actions and takes account of his actions, he's opening a book, and those pages, on the pages of the book, are his actions. دَوَاوِينَ أَعْمَالِهِمْ, what actions he's doing from morning till afternoon, from afternoon till evening, his speech, his interactions with people, whether he gets angry or he controls his anger, his eyes, his hands, his mouth, his whatever, his ears, all his body parts, how is he using them?
Sayyid Razi, also known as Sharif Razi, was a reserved scholar and historian who played a crucial role in compiling the sermons, letters, and sayings of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, into the book Peak of Eloquence. His dedication to preserving the teachings and wisdom of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, has ensured that future generations have access to the profound insights and spiritual guidance found within Nahjul Balagha. All of this is presented to you in the program Gate of Knowledge on Iran Radio.
Now, in this time, in this phrase, Imam Ali alayhi salam is explaining us that the people who remember God, those who are the Ahlu Dhikr, or they are the rememberers of God, how is their situation? Of course, Ahlul Dhikr that I mentioned are of different levels. The highest levels are the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, who even a speck of darkness cannot be imagined for them. But this is about other people who remember God at the lower level. What is their state? And even at the higher level, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, because of their interactions with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at that very high level, is something that we cannot really fathom in true sense. But in generally, these people who remember God, They are the remembrance of God. What do? They keep a time whereby they take account of their actions. وَفَرَغُوا لِمُحَاسَبَةِ أَنفُسِهِمْ They find time to think about their actions, to take account for their actions. عَلَى كُلِّ صَغِيرَةٍ وَكَبِيرَةٍ For every big and small action, even the smallest of speech that they speak, the very most trivial of actions, even they take those into account. And this is how they actually reach a state whereby they refine their souls to be people who remember God at all times. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Gate of Knowledge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
وبالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا
In the limelight.
WikiLeaks has revealed that the United States transferred $472.6 million through Internews Network, a global media non-governmental organization suspected of promoting covert censorship and media control. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Turkey's TRT World has covered this story and tells us more. Earlier this month, in a stunning disclosure, WikiLeaks revealed that the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, has bankrolled hundreds of media organizations worldwide over the years, sparking concerns about free and independent media. In a post on X, on 6th of February, the renewed whistleblowing website, WikiLeaks said, USAID had financed over 6,200 journalists across 707 media organizations as well as 279 media non-governmental organizations. This explosive revelation immediately ignited debates about whether such financial ties could compromise the integrity of journalism and the credibility of the news outlets receiving the funds. The disclosure came days after the U.S. administration's announcement in late January regarding the freezing of foreign aid through an executive order titled Reevaluating and Realigning United States Foreign Aid. The executive order, which imposed a 90-day pause on all U.S. foreign development assistance programs, was designed to allow Donald Trump's administration to reassess the effectiveness and alignment of these initiatives with the America First agenda that has been widely talked about. During a speech in Las Vegas, Nevada on 25th of January, Donald Trump defended the decision, describing it as a necessary step to redirect resources towards domestic priorities. The executive order, which claimed that some foreign aid programs were not aligned with America's interests and in some cases antithetical to American values, has now been cast in a new light following WikiLeaks' revelations. Media analysts argue that the USAID funding could easily serve as a tool for media manipulation in news organizations that have been recipients of US funds over the years or even decades. According to WikiLeaks, US aid has provided support to media outlets in more than 30 countries. A since-deleted fact sheet from the agency revealed that starting back in 2003, USAID funded training and resources for approximately 6,200 journalists, supported 707 non-state news organizations, and backed 279 civil society groups, exposing the vast extent of direct US influence in global media systems over the past two decades. The scale of this involvement is further reflected in the 2025 foreign aid budget, which includes a $268.4 million allocation from U.S. Congress specifically earmarked for initiatives aimed at fostering the so-called independent media and a free flow of information. One of the most notable disclosures from the WikiLeaks expose involves the US-financed non-profit organization Internews Network, which has reportedly directed nearly $500 million into so-called media projects across the globe. This has given rise to important questions, such as, to what extent is media independence truly possible when financial lifelines are tied to foreign governments with their own nefarious agendas? Leaked documents further indicated that Internews partnered with 4,291 media organizations, producing 4,799 hours of programming in a single year and reaching an estimated 778 million people worldwide. While Internews Network claims that its mission is to bolster independent journalism and expand access to information, the vast scope of its operations has raised legitimate questions about potential for undue or even manipulative influence over media narratives. USAID has allocated $472.6 million to Internews Network over the years, though the organization also receives financial support from private donors, including the America Online Time Warner Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and many others. Specific grants highlight the breadth of these initiatives. For instance, USAID provided $10.7 million to Internews Network to support high-quality, responsible journalism in Liberia, and $11 million for a so-called media-enabling democracy program in Moldova. According to revealed documents, the U.S. State Department also contributed $1.48 million to establish safe, accessible and life-saving information services in South Sudan. In Jordan, in the Middle East, USAID issued a $19.5 million grant to Internews to help position Jordanian society to effectively advocate for citizen-driven interests. Founded in 1982, Internews Network is headquartered in California and operates in more than 30 countries. It maintains major offices in the United States, London, Paris, and also in Kiev, Bangkok, and Nairobi. Over the years, Internews Network has expanded its reach significantly across the globe, positioning itself as a key player in global media development. The website NewsBulls has also covered the same story and tells us more. Internews Network, a global media non-profit organization, is led by Jean Burgold, who reportedly earns an annual salary of $451,000. She previously worked at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow during the early 1990s, where she managed a $250 million budget, most of which was designed for regime change purposes. Her eventful career has included involvement in various conflict zones and pivotal geopolitical moments, as well as a 6-year tenure at USAID before she assumed leadership at Internews Network. In 2023 alone, Internews Network received nearly $500 million from USAID, underscoring its significant role in global media initiatives and revealing the personal clout of former USAID official Burgholt. The organization collaborates with 4,291 radio and television stations worldwide and print publications as well, while also training more than 9,000 media professionals annually. Last year, Internews Network produced or facilitated the creation of 4,799 hours of television and radio programming, reaching an estimated 396 million radio listeners and 382 million television viewers. In Ukraine, USAID funding has been particularly extensive, supporting 9 out of 10 media outlets in Ukraine, and their job has been to amplify pro-NATO and pro-war narratives. Additionally, 25 media organizations, including media outlets like Stuff, NZME, Business Desk, News Hub, and iNews, have received financial backing through USAID and Internews Network. WikiLeaks has also revealed financial ties between major New Zealand media groups and Internews Network, raising questions about the extent of US government influence on the country's media landscape. The leaked document suggests that USAID funding has placed these outlets in a precarious position of dependency, implying that without foreign financial support and an externally managed advertising structure, their survival could be at risk. Through Internews Network, USAID has reportedly funded 25 prominent New Zealand media organisations, including Stuff, NZME, Business Desk, News Hub, and One News. In New Zealand, this funding has been funneled through initiatives like Group M, New Zealand's Back to News campaign, which aims to redirect advertising revenue towards what it describes as credible news publishers.
Thank you.